We're Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The stories of Ben Fletcher, the International Workers of the World organizers known as the Wobblies, the black wobbly dock worker who led the most powerful democratic union.
We're now joined by Peter Cole, author of Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly.
So Ben Fletcher is the person who we're really sort of focusing on. He was, I suggest, the most important leader in the IWW's most effective interracial union, which controlled the Philadelphia waterfront for about a decade because of its militancy and direct action tactics and commitment to revolutionary unionism. Fletcher is one of the most important black labor figures in the history of the United States, yet very few people, even on the left, know his name. Yet he couldn't be more relevant to more time and to many of the political projects of our time. I hope you'll agree. Ben Fletcher helped build the most important interracial, multi-ethnic union in the early 20th century. Ben Fletcher was a founder of and a leader in Local 8, which was the branch in the Industrial Workers of the World that the Philadelphia dock workers belonged to. When I think about Ben Fletcher, I think about him as a sort of a central figure in sort of the struggle against racism, the struggle against capitalism, the struggle really for Black liberation, but also the struggle for a socialist world. He was the leader when he first became leader in this union. Actually, the union was majority white, although over time became predominantly Black. And thinking about Ben Fletcher, not just as a wobbly, but also just sort of as a sort of a militant African-American in an era of tremendous racism are sort of subjects that are important for, I think, us to think about. But also, honestly, in the early 20th century, the United States was incredibly racist. Was incredibly xenophobic, where extreme socioeconomic inequality existed, arguably more so, right? Like, and so you think things might be rough today. Honestly, the early 20th century was even more challenging for many of us. The Industrial Workers of the World, I am aware many people in this audience may be familiar with, but just quickly, because I like to assume nothing about people. You know, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, was founded in 1905. It was founded because not only was capitalism failing most people in the United States, the so-called labor movement of that era, which was represented by the American Federation of Labor, chose not to organize women, chose not to organize African-Americans, chose not to organize most immigrants, chose to not organize most workers in the working class. Right? Because they chose to be predominantly white, male, native-born in skilled occupations. And they chose to focus exclusively on so-called bread-and-butter issues, essentially wages and hours and conditions without anything else, right? The same time period, 1905, racism was rampant. This is just 9 years after Plessy v. Ferguson legalized racial segregation in the United States. Immigration was very high in this era, but xenophobia was ferocious. When the IWW was founded in Chicago in 1905, it was essentially very much by the people who were leaders in unions and socialist organizations that were very intentionally creating a socialist labor movement in opposition to the American Federation of Labor. That's why basically it was a veritable who's who of people on the left, right? Eugene Debs, the leader of the Socialist Party, but before that, the leader of the Pullman strike in 1894, maybe the most important strike of the late 19th century, was a co-founder. Mother Jones, a socialist and legendary labor organizer and opponent of child labor, was there. Lucy Parsons, the widow of Albert Parsons, one of the Haymarket martyrs, was a co-founder. Big Bill Haywood, the leader of the most militant and largest mine worker union in the West, was there and was the sort of, chair of the convention, which he called the Continental Congress of the Working Class. 1905 Chicago, I'm speaking to you actually from Chicago tonight, right, was the place to be, right? Like that was also happened to be the greatest industrial city in the country, right? The IWW not only thought of itself as a socialist movement, it very much thought of itself as an internationalist movement. That's why their name is the Industrial Workers of the World. Yeah, plain and simple. Some people suggested it should be called the Industrial Workers of America in opposition to the American Federation of Labor. And in fact, that was voted down. And instead, they created an Industrial Workers of the World model, right? And then within just a few years, there were IWW branches in dozens of countries, right? And so although it was largest in the United States and arguably most influential, right, in the United States for several decades, it was a global struggle because they understood in 1905 that capitalism was global. And so therefore the solution to capitalism has to be global, right? And so that is all to their credit that the IWW was thinking in these ways, right, in 1905. And their members are often called Wobblies, and their motto, which many other unions later adopted, is an injury to one is an injury to all, right? Now, Ben Fletcher wasn't in Philadelphia, not in Chicago in 1905. He was just 15 years old. But he was born and raised in the city of Philadelphia, where many of you may be right now. His parents were originally from Virginia, and they moved to Philadelphia maybe in the late 1880s. Based on the age of his parents, it is a very good chance that his parents were born enslaved in the 1850s, although we don't know that, and Fletcher never said as much, right? But it's the great majority of Black people in Virginia and before the Civil War were enslaved, and so his parents very likely were also. We just know that they moved to Philadelphia in the late 1880s and that Fletcher was born in 1890. Yeah, when Fletcher was born in Philadelphia, it's a very interesting place. It's the largest Black population outside of the South at that time. Had a long and an old Black community, was where, for instance, the African Methodist Episcopal Church was founded. It was a leading center of the abolitionist movement, but also it was deeply racist, right? And W.E.B. Du Bois, the legendary Black radical and intellectual and activist, wrote his first book called The Philadelphia Negro, published in 1899. And he basically was writing about South Philadelphia because at that time, that was where most Black people lived. He said basically the Black experience is defined by racism, especially in occupations, that basically Black men and Black women's job opportunities were very limited, regardless of the skills that they may have had, the ambition that they might have had, right? Philadelphia was also legendary for being a very conservative city. For those of you in Philadelphia, that may not sound surprising, right? Philadelphia was considered to be a very anti-union town, even though it was heavily industrialized, the third biggest city and one of the most important industrial centers of the country. That's why it was called by one labor organizer the graveyard of unionism and another as a scab town. Now, 1910, or maybe 1911, honestly, we're not sure, Ben Fletcher joined the IWW and the Socialist Party, which was Debs's party, right? It was very common, actually, in the first 5 or 8 years of the IWW for people to be in both the IWW, the labor movement, and the Socialist Party, a political movement. Right. And in fact, socialists saw the IWW for a while as the trade union arm of the socialists. There was, however, for a number of reasons, rifts in among these groups. Anti-leftists will be familiar with left sectarianism. Yeah. And so there were divisions then, and essentially most of the Wobblies left the socialists and vice versa in the early 19 teens. Right. And so Fletcher probably left the Socialist Party shortly after he joined, although we're not really sure. He also was working on the waterfront and various other occupations by the hour. But very quickly in 1911, no later than 1912, he shows up in IWW newspapers for being an important organizer in the Philadelphia area, not just in Philadelphia, but up and down the Delaware River, including down in Chester, for example. And I do want to highlight also, he would have been organizing among predominantly white and European immigrants, right? At that time, most people in the Wobblies were in fact not African Americans. Now, I just want to talk quickly about dock work because, well, that's his occupation and that was the union he led. In Philadelphia, just like every other port city in the country and pretty much around the world, dock workers would be hired by the job. They'd have to go down to the riverfront, the Delaware, maybe the Schuylkill, and get picked by the boss, right? But hundreds of people might show up for dozens of jobs, right? There was no guarantee you'd get a job that day. Right. This was called the shape up, and dock workers hated it because you often didn't get hired and you were often being basically pitted against each other. Right. The boss had all the power, right? All the hiring. You often had to bribe the boss in order to get a job, or you might be of the same ethnic group, the same religious group, the same neighborhood group, et cetera. In other words, the boss played favorites. Right. And so the shape up was the classic divide and conquer strategy. Right, that employers use all across the United States and our world, whether it's 1913 or whether it's 2021. And it was widely understood as such. If you got hired on the docks in Philadelphia, or for that matter, other places, it's also important to understand this work was incredibly hard, very dangerous, hours were long. Shifts might be literally 24 to 36 hours. And the weather could be bad. It could be day. It could be night. It could be raining. It could be snowing. You could die any time you walk onto the waterfront, right? And everyone also understood that. In fact, one of the most dangerous occupations for many generations was dock work, right? But after you finish that job, whether you're loading or unloading a ship, you may not have another job for days, weeks, or months, right? This is called casual labor, or precarious work, as we now refer to it. The only other point I like to make about dock workers, although I could talk for a long time about the occupation, is that although it's very hard to get a job, dock workers work in pairs and in gangs, right? And so it's important to understand that the nature of the work is collective, which inculcates into workers a collective identity. We need each other. You can't load or unload a ship by yourself. You can't load or unload even maybe that cargo sling by yourself, right? You need each other. And also, who's going to look out for you in the event that something is dangerous or you get hurt, right? Simultaneous, there is no upward mobility. No dock worker becomes a ship owner. Right. And ship owners and the other employers very much saw and sort of encouraged this us versus them mentality as well. This fits very nicely, admittedly, with the IWW vision of that workers and employers share nothing in common. Right. And we have to keep that in mind. But we have to understand that even without unions, workers are developing collective identities, right, and working class identities, and often are working together, even without a union, formal union, to sort of maybe improve their conditions. Now in Philadelphia, in this time period, the city is large, it's the third largest city in the country, over 1 million people, is very diverse, but it's relatively less diverse than say New York or Chicago. But the waterfront is maybe one third African-American workers, one third Irish and Irish-American, and maybe a third other European immigrants, Poles, Lithuanians, Eastern European Jews, Italians, and so on, right? Now, this sort of workplace, or I should say this sort of workforce, most unions at that time won't touch, right? Why? Because it has too many Black people and immigrants, right? Like the IWW, of course, has no prejudice against people based on race or nationality, sex or craft, right? Now, that doesn't mean always in practice the IWW lived up to its wise ideals. None of us do, right? But the IWW was founded upon the idea that we will organize all workers, right? Period, right? And so whereas most unions didn't want to touch a diverse workforce like this one, the IWW was ready. So in the spring of 1913, thousands of dock workers in Philadelphia went on strike. And it was during this strike that Ben Fletcher and the IWW basically show up and organize these people better, charter a union called Local 8. And this strike, even before it was won, it already demonstrated what the IWW was interested in doing. They organized a diverse work committee, strike committee, I should say, just like the year before in the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. One member of every ethnic group on strike was on the strike committee, right? And so they wanted to make sure equal representation was part and parcel of their activism. After 2 weeks on strike, they had won. They won a raise, but they also won union recognition from the employers. And for the next almost 10 years, Local 8 dominated the waterfront. What did Local 8 do? So again, just quickly, first and foremost, Local 8 immediately integrated itself, right? Now the union was already open to and had members of, but before the union controlled the waterfront, gangs were racially and ethnically segregated. That was normal, not just in the waterfront, but most every workplace in America was segregated by race, ethnicity, and gender, okay? Local 8 integrates the gangs. How do we break down racism? We get to know each other, right? We work together. Right. Then we learn, in fact, we probably have more in common than we have differences. Right. And so they integrated the work gangs. Who had created segregation? The bosses. Right. This is 51 years before the Civil Rights Act of 1964 forced many institutions in America to integrate. Right. And so this is, I call this integration from below. Right. Because this was forced from below. Not only do they integrate the gangs, their social and political events are all integrated according to all records we have. And leadership ranks were also integrated, meaning that it was required that there would be equal numbers of African-American and white people in leadership positions within the local. When the union also took control, they abolished the shape-up. Let me repeat that. They abolished the shape-up. Instead, the bosses would have to call up the union hall, right, and say, we want, say, 50 workers to show up at Pier 13 tomorrow morning, and then the union will distribute the work, right? Who gets the work? If you've paid your dues, dues are actually very low in the IWW, right? You get a monthly button. Here's a few pictures of these buttons. Some people on eBay drive up the price of these things, and so I don't really own many of them, right? But nevertheless, there's some of these buttons are still out there for those who are into collectibles, right? And if you had the right button, because after all, there's thousands of guys on the waterfront. You don't know who's in the union and who's a sort of a loyal member and who's not. But if you see everyone's button on their jacket or their hat, you know. The bosses also know this. And so when the bosses try to hire people who might not be union or sort of good members in standing, other workers basically say, we won't work with these guys unless you fire them and call the hall up to get some members of our union who are in fact in good standing, right? And if you don't, we're gonna strike, right? Because of course the Wobblies great always said the greatest power workers have is to stop work, right? Now the Local 8 also did things like they celebrated their strikes. Their birthday. Every year they had an annual strike. They stopped work because what better way to celebrate work than to not work, right? This is one or several examples of what the Wobblies often called and still call direct action, right? Many of these are not documented, right? We know about some of these actions, but it's impossible that we could know about all of them. The strike and the threat of the strike is actually one of the key tactics that the IWW promoted. Let us note that this was understood before the IWW, and this is not unique to the IWW, right? Workers understand these things, even if you're not in the Wobblies, right? But the Wobblies very much promoted these ideas of direct action. It was core to their ideology, right? The waterfront in Philadelphia was dominated by the IWW for upwards of 10 years into really almost 1923, right? And Fletcher was an important leader, but not the only important leader in this story. But let me talk more about Fletcher. So Ben Fletcher was the most important African-American in Philadelphia, but also in the entire IWW. It was understood as such. And so he was often sent to organize workers, black and white workers in other ports, Boston, Providence, New York, Baltimore, Norfolk, Virginia, right? And other ports up and down the coast. The IWW also understood that, you know, if shipping companies can basically move their cargo around and weaken the workers by sending the work to other ports where they don't have to deal with the IWW, right? And so Fletcher one time when he was down in Norfolk in early 1917 was threatened with a lynching, right? He was organizing on the Norfolk waterfront. The image on the left is of a Norfolk waterfront. The image on the right is of a Norfolk dock worker, not Fletcher. He heard that he was supposed to, he might get killed. And so friends of his put him aboard a ship and sent him up to Boston, right, in early 1917, where he ended up living and organizing for several more months. It was in Boston, actually, when the United States declared war, right, World War I, 1917, right? As soon as the United States government declared war, what happened? The US Congress passed the espionage law that made it essentially a crime to speak out against the war. They also passed something called the Sedition Act, which reinforced that, right? Fletcher and hundreds of other IWW leaders from around the country were immediately surveyed, spied on, right? And started to be investigated because immediately after the United States declared war, the first group of people in the United States that the federal government went after were the Wobblies, because it was the largest, most powerful revolutionary organization in the country, right? Fletcher and hundreds of others received basically indictments and were sentenced or sent to trial. And Fletcher famously was part of the largest of these trials in Chicago in 1918, the spring and summer of 1918, where about 100 people, Fletcher being the only African-American, were put on trial for espionage and sedition. It, of course, is during this time that Fletcher became known beyond his friend group, right? That he was a really funny guy, right? Because there are several famous quotes of his from when he was on trial. The most famous of which is that when the judge started to issue sentences at the end of the trial and Fletcher turned to his friend, Big Bill Haywood, and said, geez, the judge isn't using very proper grammar this evening. How's that been? Well, his sentences are much too long, right? Any academic could of course be accused of that same crime, long sentences. So like Fletcher and about 100 people are sentenced to prison for the crime. What is their crime? Their crime is being radical, right? I mean, there's actually zero evidence brought to the trial specifically against Ben Fletcher, zero evidence brought to pretty much anyone in Philadelphia. And really they were tried based on their words, which is that they were critical of the United States war effort, right? Of course, many other people were also sentenced to prison for the same crime, the most famous being Eugene Debs, who also was sentenced to prison for speaking out against the war. Fletcher received a 10-year sentence and a $30,000 fine. When you adjust for inflation, you're talking about upwards of a $300,000 fine, right, for the crime of being a radical. This photograph and the other one that's on the cover of my book and other places are actually the photographs of when he was arrived in prison in Leavenworth, Kansas in September of 1918 to begin his 10-year pull. Of course, Leavenworth is famous as being a place where there was lots of radicals sent during and after World War I. There was over 100 Wobblies there. There were communists there. There were pacifists there. There were quote, common criminals there. There were Mexican revolutionaries like Ricardo Flores Magón was there. Fletcher didn't talk about his time in prison very much, but Magón talked about it as he felt it was cut by the formidable mechanism of a monstrous machine in my flesh, yet ripped open and my bones crushed and my moans fill the space, right? And so while Fletcher was in prison in Leavenworth, the picture on the right includes Fletcher and some other people, right? That's sometimes was nicknamed the University of Radicalism because there were so many radicals in Leavenworth in the late 19-teens and early 1920s. Of course, the federal government continued to spy on Fletcher and all the other political prisoners. And that's ironically why we have a lot of good evidence about what Fletcher was thinking and writing about while he was in prison is because we have this. And most of my book is in fact original documents about everything that Fletcher wrote and everything that was written about Fletcher. But one letter that Fletcher wrote is highlighted here. He wrote it on New Year's Eve, right before 1920. Remember, the Soviet-Russian Revolution had begun just a few years earlier. There's an Irish Revolution, there's a Mexican Revolution. A lot of people thought that there was going to be a lot more revolutions happening in the world in 1920. And so Fletcher, when he writes to a friend, a socialist in Milwaukee, New Year's Eve, 1920, he says, "We live in momentous times. None of us are gifted with the power of clairvoyance as to be able to foretell the day or the hour. Therefore, the first and most important duty is for all of us to prepare ourselves for the final chapter in the life of capitalism." Fletcher was still in prison, but Local 8 continued to hold on to power. In fact, Philadelphia was a very important port, and I should note that a lot of war material was sent out of Philadelphia, and even though the government hated the Wobblies, supposedly, they continued to use IWW members because they controlled the waterfront. I'll try to sort of wrap this up more quickly. In late 1922, Local 8, Fletcher is actually out of prison by late 22. Local 8 is pushing for the 8-hour day. Employers don't want to give it. There is a huge wave of repression against unions in the years after World War I. There are a bunch of big strikes, most of which fail. There's also rising racism and xenophobia. Congress will pass a law that basically dramatically cuts immigration. The Ku Klux Klan has several million members, right? The list of sort of racism, xenophobia can go on. Local 8 splits, right? It can't sort of handle the sort of the racism, the xenophobia, as well as the significant government repression at the local and federal levels. A few years later, the Philadelphia waterfront is reorganized by the more mainstream union, the International Longshore Association, which is part of the AFL. The ILA was able to get an 8-hour day and a union contract for its Philadelphia members, but Local 8 was a very different thing. Local 8 was a democratic union and the ILA was not. And although African Americans were belonged to the ILA, the gangs were resegregated. The shape-up was resumed. The union did not fight to try to prevent those things. And in fact, it wasn't until the 60s, really the late 60s or into the 70s even, that gangs and the unions itself was more integrated. The IWW continued to be anti-racist. This image on the left is sort of an amazing image, right, which I know very little about, unfortunately, but its power diminished. Fletcher, meanwhile, had moved to New York City around 1930-31. Why? I'm not sure. I wish I knew. He was still committed to the IWW and an organizer in Lower Manhattan, lived in Brooklyn with his second wife, but he had a series of major health problems, including several strokes in the 30s and 40s. And so even though he was not an old man by any means, really his sort of best days, including his organizing days, were behind him, although he would spoke in public on a number of occasions in the 30s, into the mid-30s, and people continually remarked about how powerful a speaker he remained. He lived in a neighborhood called Bedford-Stuyvesant that at that time was not predominantly Black, although it later became so. And he died in 1949 and is buried in Brooklyn in an unmarked grave, although there's a group of us who are actively working to sort of raise funds in order to get a marker for him in the section of that Brooklyn Cemetery. And that's going to happen this year, guys and gals, right? And so pay attention, because we're going to start asking for money, right, to raise funds for that marker, which we're excited about happening in 2021. So Fletcher was a brilliant man. He was probably, well, he remains the most important African-American in the IWW. I always say to people who are unfamiliar with the Wobblies, if you've heard of Fred Hampton, you should know about Ben Fletcher, right? They were about the same age when they were most radical. Fletcher was a socialist militant radical who had organized an interracial union in an incredibly racist and xenophobic time, right? He was committed to socialism and unapologetic, and he went to prison for it, right? And he suffered other consequences, as did many other Wobblies, right? He remained committed to the IWW, but more broadly to socialism until his dying days.
You were listening to Peter Cole, author of Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly. Peter, thank you for lifting up Ben Fletcher's remarkable legacy. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.